This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
This is the BBC.
Welcome to the Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. In this episode, we'll be getting briefed on France as it heads into the final round of an election that has shattered the traditional two-party system.
Moi, Général de Gaulle, j'entreprends ici, en Angleterre, cette tâche nationale.
The voice of General Charles de Gaulle in 1940, recorded here at the BBC, calling for the French to join the resistance against the Nazis.
Vive la France! Libre dans l'honneur et dans l'indépendance.
I'm speaking into a Type A Marconi microphone. It's just the kind that Charles de Gaulle used to send his words out into the darkness of occupied France. It's heavy. We reckon it's about 3 kilograms. It looks like a small brass obelisk and has the smell of an old box or old book. The object in front of me says France matters to us, and that what happens in the final round of France's presidential election is of great moment to Britain. For the first time in over half a century, two insurgents have broken through the traditional two-party system, and on Sunday, the voters will decide between two utterly different visions of France and of Europe and the world.
Les Français veulent l'espoir. L'optimisme, c'est pour cela qu'ils nous ont placés en tête.
Je compte sur vous, je compte sur le peuple de France, ce peuple fier et patriote.
But how did France get here? What do we need to know about its state, its economy and its changing people? Join me in the briefing room for an anatomy of France. First, a little essential information about the past. Jonathan Fenby is author of The History of Modern France and is Director of European Political Analysis at the TSL Research Company. Few better to sketch for us the historic landscape of France.
The past is important for every country, but for France, it frames the way the nation works today. The French people have, in many ways, become prisoners of their own heritage. The present presidential election is a product of history as well as of current day politics. France was the nation of La Gloire under the Sun King Louis XIV in the 17th and 18th centuries when it dominated the continent and engaged in a running conflict with the maritime power of Britain. The king declared l'état c'est moi, the state is me, and installed a 73-metre gallery of 357 mirrors at his great palace in Versailles so that he and the court could admire themselves. That feeling of being a special nation, along with a barely sublimated hankering for a monarchical ruler, has persisted to this day. France found a new vocation as the home of the Revolution of 1789, proclaiming the rights of man and liberty, equality, fraternity. Under this new regime, the subjects of the king became supposedly equal citizens of the Republic. The 19th century saw two more revolutions in the name of progress, and the Third Republic, which developed the idea of laïcité, or secularism, as the anchor of the state in opposition to the previously dominant Catholic Church.
Pour la défense de nos revendications, dans le calme et la dignité. Le voulez-vous, camarade?
Then, in the 20th century, the Popular Front of 1936 unrolled social reforms, including a 40-hour working week and paid holiday, which were consolidated after the Second World War with the welfare state and nationalisations, reforms which remain central to France today. But each of these historic moves to the left gave way to a lurch to the right. The First Revolution ended with the military dictatorship of Napoleon Bonaparte. The convulsions of the Paris Commune of 1870, aiming to install a socialist regime in the capital, were swiftly eradicated by the Third Republic, the ultimate bourgeois regime, which refused to give votes to women. The revolutionary spirit was alive during the 1968 student riots and strikes. But this upheaval was immediately followed by a big conservative majority at legislative elections. Having started in 2012 with a leftist programme, President Hollande decided to tack to the centre. He reacted to the terrorist attacks of the past 2 years with a state of emergency and a military presence on city streets. As the saying goes, France's heart is on the left, its wallet on the right. The French still see themselves as the beacon for humanity and liberal thought, but when the chips are down, they show themselves to be predominantly conservative. The irony of this year's election is that Emmanuel Macron, the presidential candidate who has upset the apple cart, is by background a product of the establishment.
Face à l'obscénité du Front National, nous allons construire et nous allons refonder.
He says he wants to shake up the system and the economy, which has left the National Front's Marine Le Pen to position herself as the defender of the status quo, of jobs and of the welfare system.
Nous allons arracher la France des mains de prétendues élites qui la confisquent, la brident, l'égarent et lui parlent toujours d'autre chose que d'elle-même.
The two mainstream parties, of left and right, have been swept away for the time being. It seems a moment for a fresh French revolution. But if the past is any guide to the way the country works, this will end up in compromise that will preserve the nation and prevent it from taking too much of a leap in the dark.
Jonathan Fenby. Joining me in the briefing room now are two people who know contemporary France well. Catherine Gilliardi is a veteran journalist with Radio France, an author, documentary maker, and an expert on French immigration, and she's in Paris. And Jacques Rélan is a political scientist specialising in French politics and economics, working at the Global Policy Institute at London Metropolitan University, but living in Brittany from where he joins us. In this programme, to build up our anatomy of France, we're going to discuss its critical systems, the economy, the state, immigration and security. And for each subject, we've asked BBC reporter Estelle Doyle to tell us the essential facts. Here's what we need to know about the economy.
The French economy is the second largest in the group of countries that use the euro. It has been slow to recover from the 2008 financial crisis. Growth has lagged behind Germany and the UK. The French government has been spending more than it brings in. Last year, it ran one of the biggest deficits in the G7. Unemployment is nearly 10%, more than twice that of Britain and Germany. Youth unemployment is particularly bad at 25%.
Estelle Doyle. So, Catherine, why is unemployment in France so high?
Ooh, that's a huge question, because unemployment has been high for many years. If you look at the last 20 years, at least, it's been at this 10% rate that Estelle Doyle was talking about. Some say that it is because of the way that the labor load, the code of labor, as we call it here, is made, meaning that companies cannot make people redundant very easily, that it costs a lot to hire someone, it costs a lot to fire him or her. And other people say that, well, unemployment is high because there is a lack of education, because people, especially over 50s, for example, who are on the dole, have not followed a continuous training. So it's a problem of education.
Jacques, how does this situation pan out where you live?
Yeah, I'm in Brittany. Actually, I live in a seaside town called Saint-Malo, which is just south of Jersey and Portsmouth. And it gets lots of British tourists who frequent the many restaurants that we have there. But unfortunately, in these restaurants, they often find that they have to wait a fair amount of time for their dish to arrive, because very often these restaurants are understaffed. And that is one of the problems that French employers complain about, is the payroll taxes, the social contributions. When French employers want, thinks he needs more staff, he carefully considers how much it will cost him or her. In France, when you hire someone, you pay the gross wage plus, depending on the level of wages, they have around 40% contributions on top of that. That's for the employers. And the workers also get their pay deducted. So that's the main bane of the French employers. They say, we don't hire because it costs too much. I've noticed the French, they always complain about the social contributions. But at the same time, I think that a lot of employers, a lot of businesses in France are fairly Malthusian approach. They don't want to do too much. They want a quiet life, and they want to limit their expenses. And they're not very happy to grow their businesses. And we see that when we compare France to Germany, we have far fewer middle-sized companies. In France, there's lots of very small companies, large companies, but it's the middle band that we are short of, and especially middle band of ambitious exporting companies.
If your employers are not employing as many people, but yet having effectively, they still open their restaurants and they still run their businesses, does that mean that France is actually more productive per employee than somewhere like the United Kingdom?
Indeed, I mean, French productivity per hour work per worker is from 20 to 25 more than in Britain.
So France has 20 to 25% greater than in Britain. So the average French worker produces 20 to 25% more in value than the British worker.
Yeah, we work less, you know, 35-hour week and so on. So the average hourly, yearly hours worked by French workers is far less. But they produce as much. We have a GDP, an output, which is about the same as Britain, but we far fewer workers. Britain has made the choice of jobs. France has made the choice of productivity. I mean, now we see that jobs are created, but when people are hired for work, they're hired on very short-term contract. 80% of employment in France is now in the form of either temp work or very short-term contracts. Sometimes it can be a month contract. So it's very difficult in France to get the holy grail for French workers is to get what is known as the CDI, a long-term contract. Because when you have a job in France, you're very well protected. And that's why employers, that's why, for example, Macron is talking about reforming the labor laws, or it's been happening. Employers find it very reluctant to hire because they think it might be difficult to get rid of a worker if the economic situation of the company goes down, or if this worker proves not to be very competent.
Labor laws make it very difficult for employers to make people redundant, but there are people that are made redundant very regularly. And Whirlpool is the last example where French people will lose jobs because simply it's cheaper to produce washing machines in Poland.
Whirlpool is the company that became famous because both presidential candidates visited it on the same day.
And they visited it because it's the big thing of the moment. I mean, we had different companies in France who are sort of French trademark that is well known, that are suddenly losing ground and suddenly announcing that they will close down. And Whirlpool actually is doing pretty well, but simply is cheaper to produce in Poland. So how do we stop that happening? And it's also important to say that the French economy hasn't been doing very well. I mean, the regions where Marine Le Pen has very strong hold of voters are regions of former industries in the north and the southeast. And clearly, we also have this problem of France not entering globalization, maybe at the same pace than other countries. It's not only the fact that employers cannot make people redundant, it's just there are less jobs, simply.
Who are the unemployed, typically?
They are mostly non-qualified or underqualified people. They said an employment rate is three times as high for people without a diploma. And what we call diploma is baccalaureate plus 2 years after, baccalaureate being about the A level. And youth under 25, 25% of the unemployed are under 25, and over 50 and over, mainly because of a lack of training or continuous training in the field, or just of changing jobs, changing speciality. This is very difficult in France to do something else than what you have been trained for.
With so many people unemployed, what's life like on benefits?
I think compared to Britain, incredibly well treated. I mean, I know I've got a first-hand example of my wife, who had worked in Britain as a teaching assistant, and in France found a job, not very good jobs, but she worked for nearly 2 years. And as a result of that, she was made redundant because she had a short-term contract. For the last 2 years, she's been earning 70% of her previous wage, and without being pushed too much to find something else. And now unemployment period is coming to an end, but she's being, in the last few months, she started a training, and she's going to be, even though unemployment benefit should stop, she's going to be paid some money from the state, a bit less, but something like 700 euros to finish her training until July. So it's quite good. When you are unemployed, initially, for the first 2 years, when you're entitled to unemployment benefit, it's quite good. After that, the benefit, it's something else. You're no longer entitled to benefits, it's income support that you get.
We've touched upon the relationship between welfare there and the state. Let's bring back Estelle Doyle with her summary of what we need to know about the French state.
The state plays a big role in the French economy. France employs just over 5.5 million civil servants. That's 20% of the workforce. The French government owns shares in 77 companies, in fields ranging from energy and defence to the media. State-owned enterprises particularly dominate the country's transport sector. Over half of French state spending is on social security, more than all other EU and G7 countries. Public spending is 57% of GDP, which is almost a third more than in the UK.
So, Jacques, what's behind this French tradition of a big state?
After the war, France's defeat was put by many people due to the fact of lack of dynamism of that country. Remember, at that time, 50% of French workers were self-employed, while in the case it was 10% in Britain at the time. We were not a modern country. After the war, General de Gaulle and a few of the leaders that came out of the resistance decided that it was time, if France wanted to retain its status as a big power, it had to become a strong industrial and economic power. And from then on, the state played a big part in transforming the French economy. It, through nationalizations and through planning, and eventually, in the space of 30 years, France became the fourth economy in the world. The state helped to transform the French economy.
Okay, so that's a really incredibly good background. But Catherine, can you give us the psychology here? Why is the state so sacred psychologically now?
I think if we listen to Jonathan Fenby, actually, it could date back to the monarchy in a way. I mean, we have a president that we actually used to call king. I mean, François Mitterrand was called the king, you know, the father figure is very important here in France, and our presidential system shows that. The state is expected to solve about everything. We were talking about Whirlpool, this company that is going to relocate in Poland, and everybody wants the state to intervene. You know, it's normal here to think, oh, but the state should stop that.
OK, so now let's talk a bit about the changing people who live in that state. What about immigration? Estelle Doyle is here again.
France's foreign-born population is smaller than the UK's. Official figures from 2014 show 11.6% of the population was born abroad. In the UK, it was 13%. There are thought to be about 5 million Muslims in France, the biggest Muslim population in the EU. However, there is no official figure, as it is illegal in France to collect data on race and religion.
Catherine, this is your area of specialisation. So my first question is to you, how has immigration changed France in the modern era?
There is an estimation of one French person out of four having at least one foreign grandparent in France. So it means that since the 19th century, many people have arrived here in France en masse, either because of a crisis in the Eastern Europe, for example, before the 20th century, or during the 20th century, Spain, Italy, Portugal. They came after the war, the Second World War. And then came the wave of people from the colonies. France actually went to get those people to work in the French factories that we were talking about that were encouraged to develop after the war. We needed workers. So there were Moroccans, Algerians, Tunisians. And then the end of the colonies and decolonization, as we call it here, came. And then those people, some of those people chose to come and live in France, to work in France. And what happened is that they settled down and they had children and now they have grandchildren, great-grandchildren. That's why one person out of four in France is considered as having a foreign background.
Jacques Roulon, I remember very well when France won the World Cup, everybody who was talking about the nature of that team and what a great expression it was for the assimilation and integration in France. A few years on, and it's a very different kind of conversation. Which was right, the World Cup France or the anger France?
Both, in a way. Because integration policy in France has worked very well. As Catherine said, we've always been a country of immigration, and our integration policy has been based on that. Before, it used to be European, Poles, Italians, Spaniards, both Catholics, etc., who found work, and we integrated into French society through either work, sometimes the church, and eventually education for their children and the military service. The French model of integration was based on assimilation. That system worked when the economy was able to integrate the immigrants and their children. Today, we're in an economic crisis. We have been now for 30 years. Unemployment has been very high and has hit the children of immigrants, and immigrants were different too. Sometimes they were black, sometimes they were Arabs, had a different religion, Muslim. So there was a certain distress, there's a racial and Islamophobic dimension which could be there. But the main problem is these children, who are children who are culturally very French in many ways, much more than, for example, I would say, Bangladeshi in Britain. Unfortunately, their social and economic integration hasn't followed because they are discriminated against. There's a mistrust towards them on the job market. And the problem is that in France, we have a system where everyone is meant to be equal. Yes, we have a great formal equality, but in real terms, they are not economically equal. They are discriminated against. And at the same time, this model of integration in France, which is purely formal, is also falling against a new principle. People no longer want to be assimilated. They want to keep their roots, their culture. And that's why many people from Africa or elsewhere prefer to go to Britain, where they can keep on living the life, their lifestyle, while in France they're accused of being almost traitors to the nation by people like Marine Le Pen and so on, and even by the French right, by Fillon.
You talked earlier about the problems of assimilation and so on, and to a large extent these have led people to blame problems of assimilation for the terrorist attacks. And we'll talk a bit now about security. There have been many deaths, and here's Estelle Doyle with a rundown of what we need to know about security in France.
France has been hit by a string of terror attacks. Since 2015, more than 230 people have been killed in shootings, stabbings, bombings and a lorry attack. In the same period, six people were killed in two terror attacks in the UK. The French government estimates that about 2,000 people have been involved in some way in religious extremism. Hundreds of French Muslims have travelled to Iraq and Syria to fight for the so-called Islamic State. It's believed around 700 are still in the region. France has been in an official state of emergency since 2015.
Jacques, how has France responded to the terror threat?
I think France has responded remarkably well. I've been actually quite proud of France in the way they've reacted to these events, Charlie Hebdo and especially the Bataclan. And I think it's credit must be given there to François Hollande and his ministers who made sure that they did not try to blame a region for it. They did a great pedagogic work, I think, and calm things down. And it is shown by the two surveys, which are very serious surveys on the French attitude towards Islam and towards racism. And the latest survey showed quite clearly by the Human Rights National Council that tolerance in France has gone up and racism has gone down.
Do the French people believe now that the French security forces have got on top of the terrorist threat more than they were before?
I think so. I think that there's an awareness that the situation has improved. France was ill-prepared at the time of Charlie Hebdo. The Charlie Hebdo attack highlighted many of the shortcomings in the French intelligence system. And since then, a lot of measures have been taken. Most specialists agree that France has now an arsenal, an array of laws and measures which are improving the situation. And I think that we can see that the latest attack, the last coordinated attack, was against the Bataclan. Since then, we've had attacks, but they've been the fact of lone wolves, which are very difficult to spot.
Catherine, how have the attacks affected, do you think, the French psyche?
I think that the most difficult is to stay united. And this is actually Daesh's strategies to divide us. And we're talking about France, but it's not the only country that Daesh is aiming at.
Sure.
But clearly France, with its strong foreign population or population with a foreign origin and its strong Muslim population is a country that Daesh is particularly aiming at. And the division that they are trying to create in our society is what worries me the most. That's right, we have strong civilian laws now and intelligence in Europe seems to work much better because we had some people that were arrested recently in Marseille who were going to attack during the presidential election, and it seemed that they were clearly organized and they were not lone wolves. So intelligence is better, militaries are in the streets, many policemen, many militaries, but in fact, how do we keep together? How do we stay united as a country with such difficult times? And I think that the presidential elections in France that are happening this Sunday are clearly showing that there are two different answers to that for the French people. Marine Le Pen represents a kind of response, which is closing down the borders and feeling that it's the only way to protect ourselves, not only against terrorism, but economically as well. And opening up the country and collaborating with the others is Macron's answer to that fear and that very legitimate anguish.
OK, both of you, the vote is on Sunday. Here's the question you didn't want me to ask. Who's going to win, Jacques?
Macron is going to win, hands down. Yesterday's debate was the final nail in the coffin of Marine Le Pen.
Catherine, what do you think?
She doesn't have the majority of the votes, but people might not go and vote. People don't feel that there is any good solution to their anguish and to their fear for the future and the future of their children with either candidates. And Macron is expected to win, but it's never been so close. 15 years ago, Marine Le Pen's father lost. He got only, 18% of the votes? It will not be like this time.
Thank you both very much indeed. So that's one Macron and one not so sure. My thanks to Estelle Doyle and Jonathan Fenby, who you heard earlier, and to Catherine Gilliardi and Jacques Rélan. We'll be back next week, possibly asking who should pay for the Britain we want, and possibly asking something else. See you then. That's all for this episode of The Briefing Room. I'd like to thank my guests, Catherine Gilliardi and Jacques Rellon. My producer for this episode was Javier Zapata, and research was by Sarah Shabir. And if you enjoyed this episode of The Briefing Room, you might like a BBC podcast called The Inquiry. Also, if you'd like to let us know what you think about the series, there's an easy way to do it. Just write a review or rating on iTunes or your podcast provider. We look forward to reading your comments. We actually do read them.